The pursuit of wisdom has long been a major compulsion of mankind. Cicero said that wisdom is the best gift of the gods. It is the mother of all good things. And what he is saying by that is that if you can become wise, then you'll be able to obtain just about anything else. Today, we live in a society where the majority of people, I think, would claim to be wise, a culture in which no fool is a self-confessed fool, where everyone is an expert. Everyone has the answers and knows all of the answers and is able to converse on virtually any topic at all. And with the advent of social media, we now find ourselves drowning in a sea of well-informed opinions. Everyone and everyone has a forum now to make those opinions known. But as you listen to the debates and the discussions, particularly when it comes to social issues, it's very apparent that there is a vast difference between the world's wisdom and biblical wisdom. And we see that especially, for example, in the debates on abortion or homosexuality or divorce or crime or even our own origins. Though we as Christians may be viewed as the scum of the world and the dregs of all things, not my words, by the way, the words of Paul in 1 Corinthians 4 and verse 13, generally speaking, when it comes to those issues and a host of others, we are the ones that have the right answers. From the standpoint of biblical wisdom, it's not about mere intelligence, it's not about academic achievement. Wisdom has to do with our involvement with God and our involvement with others. That our world may be filled with those who are highly educated and highly trained, but wisdom involves more than just knowledge, more than just information. It's not a question of what you know. Solomon tells us that wisdom begins by us knowing God and fearing Him. That wisdom is the art of living well. That is, it's not possessed in a genuine sense unless it reshapes our life. That wisdom involves taking divine revelation and applying it properly in given situations. And the Bible regularly discusses the fact that there are two very different kinds of wisdom, that there is the wisdom of God and there is the wisdom of man. In fact, there is an entire section in the Old Testament that is devoted to denoting the differences between those two kinds of wisdom, and we refer to it as the wisdom literature. But rather than going back and looking at wisdom in the Old Testament, I want us this morning to focus on a section that is written in one of the earliest of the New Testament epistles, and that is here in the book of James. As James writes to Jewish Christians who were dispersed, he's writing to people who had as much teaching on the subject of wisdom as any group of people on the entire planet. And as he writes to these early Christians, he draws on what they would have likely referred to simply as the Scriptures. And James's mind seems to have been saturated with its truths. And not in terms of something that was creedal or something that was merely cerebral, but by way of thoughtful, practical application of divine revelation in varied circumstances. So there is a wisdom from God and a wisdom from man. There is a wisdom that is from above and there is a wisdom that is from below. There is vertical wisdom and horizontal wisdom. There's heavenly wisdom and earthly wisdom. And again, it's not about how much we know. It's about how much we live what we say that we know. So let's pick up our reading here. James chapter 3, verse 13. James says, "Who among you is wise and understanding? Let him show by his good behavior his deeds in the gentleness of wisdom. But if you have bitter jealousy and selfish ambition in your heart, do not be arrogant and so lie against the truth. This wisdom is not that which comes down from above, but is earthly, natural, demonic. For where jealousy and selfish ambition exist, there is disorder and every evil thing. But the wisdom from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, reasonable, full of mercy and good fruits, unwavering, without hypocrisy. And the seed whose fruit is righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace." You'll notice that James begins this section by a challenge to self-examination. He asks those they possess wisdom and understanding in regard to spiritual matters to step forward that he might analyze the legitimacy of their claim. And by the way, the choice of these two specific words, wisdom and understanding, I don't think is accidental. These concepts occur frequently together in the Old Testament, especially in the wisdom literature, but this is the only time that they appear together in the New Testament. In fact, the word understanding here is a unique word. This is the only occurrence of it in the New Testament, and what it spoke of is someone who was a specialist or an expert, if you will. And so James asks, among all of you who think that you are wise and understanding, who is it that really possesses these important qualities? And he follows that question with three very clear, or a command that is threefold. Who is the ones who possess wisdom? It's not those who claim it, it's those who demonstrate it in three realms. First of all, in good behavior. In a general sense, he's describing what is the pattern of your life and mind? Does it reveal the way, the work, and the will of God, or does it reveal something else? He then gets specific in terms of the word deeds there. Does it reflect the will of God, not just in some general sense, but down to specific acts of holiness that occur regularly in our life? And then third and finally, attitudinally, the gentleness of wisdom, that if you think you are wise and yet you're arrogant, you don't have it. That's what James is going to go on to say, that the true possessors of wisdom are the exact opposite of the self-consumed, self-promoting self-seekers. And so, do you claim to be wise and understanding? He says, let them show it. And by the way, it's the same phrase that he uses back in chapter 2 and verse 18 when he talks about our faith. Look at your life and what do you see? Do you see a pattern of righteousness? Do you see specific acts of holiness? Is there a spirit of humility? Then there is evidence that you possess the wisdom of God. Now, again, where did James come up with all of these ideas and these concepts about wisdom? It certainly wasn't from the Greeks, because from a Greek standpoint, wisdom involved prized intellectual ability, a knowledge of divine secrets, and gentleness in the mind of the Greek was seen as something that was unworthy of a person who was strong and confident. James's view that the proof of wisdom comes in the living is drawn directly out of their own scriptures. And of anyone who should have known the difference between the futile wisdom of man and the true wisdom that comes from divine revelation, it should have been the people that he's writing to, these Jewish Christians. One writer says that wisdom is to be found with God and nowhere else. And unless the quest for wisdom brings a man to his knees in awe and reverence, knowing his own helplessness to make himself wise, wisdom remains for him a closed book. James says that any claim to wisdom and understanding is going to be validated by our behavior. And you'll notice that he assesses this claim not so much in theological terms, but in practical terms, that true wisdom results in a changed life. And as James closes that verse 13, he provides us with information that will allow us to falsely identify the false claims from the true ones. Your conduct will either affirm or it will deny your affirmation. And he says in verse 13, let him who show by his good behavior his deeds in the gentleness of wisdom, and therefore gentleness in our behavior would validate that claim. He then moves on to verse 14, going down through verse 16, and here he paints for us a portrait of those who are the unwise, and he begins by focusing on their internal motivations. He says in verse 14, but if you have bitter jealousy and selfish ambition in your heart, do not be arrogant and so lie against the truth. Most versions translate the Greek word here with the word jealousy or envy. The Greek word here doesn't carry the same concepts that typically come to mind with those English terms. It's actually the word from which we get our English word zeal. And we understand that zeal can be positive and zeal can be negative and zeal can be neutral.
Zeal, for example, can be positive when we read back in the book of Numbers, chapter 25, where in verse 11, Phinehas has a zeal for God and God's holiness that compels him to take the lives of Israelites who are engaging in fornication with the Moabite women in Numbers chapter 25. Jesus is said to have displayed his zeal for God as he cleansed the temple in John chapter 2. But this same word that simply describes a strong feeling can also contain a negative connotation if it is describing an overblown and therefore an inappropriate devotion to the wrong kinds of things. The fact that James further qualifies it by saying it is a bitter jealousy makes it clear that he's not describing a good thing here. And as we consider the second motive that James pairs it with, selfish ambition, he gives us an even clearer picture of what is in mind here. It is an image of self-centeredness that produces a resentful attitude toward others. This is a person who lives in a me kind of world. And anyone who threatens their self-focused world is regarded as an enemy. Anyone who disagrees with them is wrong. The second element, selfish ambition, this is the only time that this word is used in the New Testament. And in fact, the only pre-New Testament occurrence of this word is in the writings of Aristotle, where he used it to describe a narrow self-seeking pursuit of political power by unjust means. That has absolutely no relevance to us today at all, does it? Some who pride themselves on their great wisdom and understanding were displaying a zealous ambition that used unworthy and divisive means to promote their own self-interest. And thus it was the exact opposite of the gentleness of wisdom that he's described in the previous verse. Simply put, the wisdom that is not from God manifests itself in a lifestyle that's marked by self-focus, self-centeredness, that's consumed with the fulfillment of human ego, that does whatever it needs to in order to bring about its own satisfaction at any cost. And James adds that if those negative traits are what mark your life and your thinking, then don't be so arrogant as to boast. That is, the idea here is to take pride in or put your confidence in the fact that you possess divine wisdom, because very clearly you are lying against what is actually true. In verse 15, he describes for us here the inherent characteristics of it. He says, this wisdom is not that which comes down from above, but is earthly, natural, demonic. In the previous verse, he described those who were selfish and partisan, that they may claim to have wisdom. But he says, look, that's not a wisdom that comes down from above. That's another way of simply saying it's not from God. He then provides us with a further description of this false brand of wisdom that is the exact opposite of the right kind of wisdom, not only in terms of its nature, but its origin. He says, first of all, it is earthly, or some versions render it earthbound, and it means exactly what we think it means. It's locked into the sphere of time and space, and therefore is clearly inferior to the heavenly variety. It is natural. Some versions render the word unspiritual. It's a rare word found only four other times in the New Testament. And what it describes is merely possessing life. It's a life that is only responsive to the stimuli of the natural world. This person's feelings and impulses and appetites are focused on the things of this realm. And then third, he describes it as being demonic. This is the only place this word is found in the New Testament. And in fact, the word doesn't even appear in Greek literature prior to the writing of James. And what he's telling us here is that that kind of wisdom, it's not divine in origin. It has a very different origin. It is demonic. It comes from Satan himself. And whenever something is described as being earthly, natural, and demonic, you can rest assured it will never lead to godly behavior. Instead, this kind of wisdom leads to immorality and smugness and arrogance and abandonment to fleshly impulses. And if you're claiming to have divine wisdom, and yet you're motivated by pride, you're controlled by the world, by your flesh, by Satan, James says, look, your claim is rendered invalid. He then describes for us the inescapable effects in verse 16. You'll notice it starts with the word for, F-O-R, and what that does is it connects it back to what James has said in the previous verses. He now looks to justify the harsh verdict that he has rendered on that kind of wisdom. He says, for where jealousy and selfish ambition exist, he reaffirms those motives that he mentioned back in verse 14. Where those things exist, he says, there is disorder and every evil thing. Here's the fruit that that kind of wisdom bears. Disorder, he says, first of all. It's actually a form of a word that he's already used twice in this letter. He used it back in chapter 1 in verse 8 to describe the double-minded man. He used it in chapter 3 in verse 8 to describe the double-speaking tongue. It's a word that denotes something that's unstable, that's restless, that's unsettled, that's in a chaotic state. Disorder is what breaks out when people pursue their own selfish concerns, their own personal agendas, their own partisan causes, rather than looking out for the good of others. Earthly, natural, demonic wisdom can never produce harmony, peace, or love, because first and foremost, it is self-seeking. And as a result of that, it destroys closeness. It destroys unity. And again, we see this going on all around us today, where people would claim to be wise, claim to be intelligent, and yet they're not walking according to divine wisdom, but earthly wisdom. He also says that it results in every evil thing. You can't really get more general than that, can you? That false wisdom produces absolutely nothing beneficial, nothing of value, and so it certainly cannot be of God. Now, James has just used his pen to tell us what the wisdom that comes from above is not. This is not true wisdom. Verse 17, he's now going to tell us in verse 17 and 18 what it is, or perhaps better, what it does. Again, James is clearly operating from the perspective that wisdom is the basic God-given orientation that profoundly affects the way a person lives. That it, just like faith that he talked about earlier in this letter, in chapter 2, verse 14 through 26, is revealed by the quality of life that it produces. And James is going to do this. He's going to tell us about true wisdom by focusing on one single motive that will then be followed by seven virtues that sound very much like the fruit of the Spirit that Paul describes in Galatians chapter 5, before he tells us what the ultimate result of that wisdom is. So here's the description of the truly wise. Here's the internal motivation, he says, in verse 17, but the wisdom from above is first pure. The word first here indicates what is of priority, what is of first importance. The Greek word that's translated pure here is not the typical word that we find in other places in the New Testament. This has to do with a moral sincerity, a blamelessness. And what James is saying is that the wisdom that comes from above is free of bitter jealousy, selfish ambition. It's free of arrogance and self-promotion, that it chooses instead to do the will of God, to love Him and to serve Him. That the possessor of that kind of wisdom is not motivated by a heart of pride, but rather an unmixed devotion and desire for purity in their life and in the lives of others. And you remember Jesus in Matthew chapter 5, and verse 8 says that those are the folks that are pure in heart, they are the ones who will see God. He then follows this with seven virtues that flow out of this prominent issue of purity. It further marks the wisdom that is from above. And let me just say, he's denoting these. If we are reading these in the original language, we would see that he sort of breaks them into three categories or three groups. The first group is marked by assonance. That is, it begins with, not only begins with the same letter, but it ends with exactly the same sound. The middle group is set apart by the phrase full of, and then the third group is marked by alliteration. They have an A sound that starts them. The first inherent characteristic that he says is that it's peaceable, that is peace-loving, peace-promoting, that the wisdom that comes from God doesn't create chaos or confusion. It is not self-promoting. The only other time, by the way, this word is found is in Hebrews chapter 12 and verse 11. The second description is that it is gentle. William Barclay said that this is one of the most difficult Greek words to translate into English, because it speaks of someone who is humbly patient, who is steadfastly gentle, who is submits to dishonor and disgrace and mistreatment, but does so with an attitude of humility, kindness, and patience without malice, hatred, or a desire for revenge. The third reasonable, the ESV says, open to reason, the New King James willing to yield. This is the only time this word is found in the New Testament. And it describes someone who is readily persuadable, but not in some gullible, weak way, but rather they're willing to receive instruction they will tend to defer rather than simply dismiss. The next one in the list, they are full of mercy, they're just completely overwhelmed with this. The wisdom that comes from above operates out of a conscious concern and compassion for other people, recognizing their need, their helplessness, especially those who suffer. It's also full of good fruits, James says. A wide array of spiritual deeds that just, again, like genuine faith, genuine wisdom, produces those things that are good and noble and righteous before God. They are unwavering, he says. It's the only time this word is used in the New Testament. And it's the exact opposite of being double-minded. This is someone who is undivided in terms of their commitment, that there's no vacillating, no shifting, no turning one way and then another. They are consistent. And then finally, they are without hypocrisy. They are utterly sincere and genuine. They're not fake or phony. That the wisdom from above doesn't lead us to try and become two different kinds of people in the same body. Instead, we are trustworthy and transparent. Virtually every verse in this section has not only has a point to make, but a significant point to make in terms of our walk as Christians, but none of them surpass the significance of the final verse. And that is, there's a different result that comes from these two types of wisdom. For the first wisdom, he said in verse 16, it results in disorder and every evil thing. But divine wisdom, he says, that in verse 18, the seed whose fruit is righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace. The indisputable effect of divine wisdom is that of righteousness and peace. And you'll notice how righteousness gets tossed in here, and for good reason, because again, the means by which we define biblical wisdom is not a matter of what's in your head, matter of what's in your life. Now, obviously, what's in your head and what's in your heart drives that. But wisdom in the Bible is a matter of living. It's about behavior. Is our behavior congruent with the character of God? And is it that which brings peace to people, in particular, the people of God? That righteousness flourishes in an atmosphere of peace. And in the hands of those who aren't concerned with self, they are instead the peacemakers that Jesus said in Matthew chapter 5. They are the ones who will be called the sons of God. But that where there is divisiveness and selfishness, there is no true wisdom, James says. Because true wisdom is pure and it is peaceable. And therefore, those who promote discord and tumult don't possess wisdom, regardless of how much they might protest to the opposite. If a person claims to be a Christian, if they say that they have divine wisdom, both their claims to being a Christian and having wisdom are validated in terms of their behavior. That the presence of divine wisdom is revealed in the way that we choose to live. And James, throughout this letter, is dealing with those who said they believed, but their belief wasn't changing their life. And so what James is doing in this letter is he's providing them with a number of tests by which they can measure the validity of the faith that they claim to have. Chapter 1. How do you respond to trial? That validates whether your faith is real or not. How do you respond to temptation? How do you respond to the Word of God? Chapter 2, how do you view other people? Do you view them with an eye of prejudice? Then you don't have the real deal. Your faith is validated, he says, at the end of chapter 2 in what you do, the works that you perform. Not meritorious works, but your conduct, your behavior. Chapter 3, how do you use your tongue? Because that will validate or it will deny the claim that you make. And then here in this section, what kind of wisdom do you operate by? You operate by a wisdom that comes from above or a wisdom that comes from below? And you'll know it. You'll know that kind of wisdom by what you see in your life. This morning, if you're not a child of God, understand that you're operating by earthly wisdom. And earthly wisdom may be saying a lot of things. Earthly wisdom may say this life is all that there is. Earthly wisdom may say you got plenty of time to make a change. Or earthly wisdom may say, well, you know what, you need to know a whole lot more than what you know right now. But divine wisdom is seen in terms of your response to that information. This morning, if you need to be a Christian, no better time. Now is what you have. Take that step and become a child of God and begin to walk by the kind of wisdom that James describes here. If we can help you to do that, won't you make that need known? Why don't we stand and sing?